The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering troubleshooting and repair services for broken or problematic Macs, iPads, and iPhones, both in warranty and out. More information at techserve.com.
I'm not leaving.
Today.
Based on what?
I would ask you all.
Why are you not issuing marriage licenses today?
Because I'm not.
Under whose authority are you not issuing
licenses? Under God's authority.
We will never accept homosexual marriage. I don't care what Supreme Court justice says what.
People who refuse to do the jobs that they were hired to do shouldn't be allowed to keep those jobs.
In the most extreme case, he could order her jailed.
Hey, ho, ho, Kim Davis has got to go, hey, hey.
Christianity is not something that we do, it's who we are. We can't go against who we are.
Most importantly, God will never accept same-sex marriage.
I just want you all to know that we are not issuing marriage licenses today.
Why?
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. Today, Federal District Judge David Bunning held Kim Davis, a clerk in Rowan County, Kentucky, in contempt of court. Now, Davis claimed that issuing the licenses would violate her First Amendment right to religious liberty, but the Supreme Court declined to rule on her appeal. So, Davis took a public stand against the law.
I just want you all to know that we are not issuing marriage license today.
Why?
Pending.
In contempt of court.
What appeal is left?
Pending the appeal in the Sixth
denied.
Circuit.
The
appeal,
appeal in the Sixth Circuit has been denied.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The injunction is the order that you're supposed to issue marriage license.
And we're not issuing marriage license today.
The Supreme Court denied your stay.
We are not issuing marriage license today.
Now, Kim Davis is not the only one invoking religious freedom in a fight against laws they don't like. And we've also been hearing a lot from you. On Facebook, there is a lively debate underway. Kyle writes, she should be allowed to deny the licenses, but she should be ready for some consequences. And maybe Kentucky should set up some sort of alternative licensing procedures to serve the public while she's taking her stand.
Hi, my name is Jessica, and I'm in San Jose, California. I'm an attorney, and I oppose the death penalty for religious and ethical reasons. I wouldn't pursue a job as a district attorney in a state that has the death penalty because doing my government job might force me to violate my beliefs. I really don't think that the situation is any different.
The Kentucky case of one clerk and her position on same-sex marriage is one glimpse into a wider legal war. All over the country, religious organizations, businesses, hospitals, churches, and religious individuals are claiming that laws from the same-sex marriage ruling to the Affordable Care Act violate their religious freedom. And the Supreme Court justices themselves are warning these cases aren't going away. So we're going to take a look now at Kim Davis, where her religious stand against same-sex marriage might go, and also at the coming wave of religious objections. Are religious people a new oppressed minority in America? Sam Markison is a constitutional law professor at the University of Louisville Brandeis School of Law in Kentucky. He says that Davis was acting in the capacity of the state, but demanding the rights of an individual.
She stands in the posture of the state itself as the elected official who is preventing any licenses from being issued. When that's the demand she's making as a result of her conscience, there really is no possibility for accommodation. She speaks for and stands in for the state. And the state itself has no religious freedom rights. It's individuals who have religious freedom rights. And if in her personal life, in her individual capacity, she wants to have her religious beliefs, stand up for those beliefs, express them, she's perfectly entitled to do that and has every First Amendment right to do that, but not when she is in the official capacity as the state. That's where the line has to be drawn. Otherwise, we have a theocracy. And when the state starts to impose its religious beliefs to the detriment of individual citizens or here couples seeking to get married, whether they be same sex or different sex, that's where the rule of law breaks down. And that is not a First Amendment right that anyone enjoys to break down the rule of law.
Now, the Supreme Court itself refused to hear a case from Kim Davis saying she has this religious right that we're talking about. But, Professor, you and I both know that there are cases popping up all over the country in a much broader context claiming First Amendment religious freedom, not only in the context of same-sex marriage, but also Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, contraception, and a lot of different areas. In the area of same-sex marriage, Michigan now has a law allowing adoption agencies to refuse to place children with legally married same-sex couples if there's a religious objection. There are cases of churches, hospitals, businesses all over the place that all point to a road leading to a bunch of cases coming toward the Supreme Court about religious objections to these laws. Let's take same-sex marriage. Where do those cases stand, and what's in the future here?
In the future, you have hard cases and easy cases, as is most of the time the case with the law. Easy cases are at both extremes. Kim Davis, frankly, is an easy case. It's why she's lost at every level. At the other extreme, there are easy cases for giving exemptions. Ministers and churches who don't want to perform same-sex weddings because those are against the faith of that church, because that's at the very core of what the First Amendment is all about. No one, since same-sex marriages have first been recognized in the United States and Massachusetts, has ever tried to compel a church to perform a wedding that is against the tenets of that faith. So that's an easy case for giving the exemption. The hard cases are in the middle, where you have private people, but maybe in the commercial sphere, who want religious exemptions. And those hard cases are the ones we're going to have to work out as a democratic society that makes these calls through our legislatures, through our city councils, and talking to each other about where the line should be drawn. Because, frankly, religious freedom is a value, is a civic virtue we believe in this country, but so too is non-discrimination. And if we're trying to balance those, the right of people not to be discriminated against, to be able to enjoy the right to go to a baker, to go to a wedding planner, etc., but also the right of people to have their religious virtues, we can balance these rights in a way that seeks to give everyone the fullest possible measure of the rights balanced against each other. And so these are difficult questions, but not impossible ones to work out if we work them out between us as a civil society. Not when government's involved, not when it's a government official seeking an exemption. That's why the Kim Davis case is ultimately controversial, but not a hard case for the law.
There is also a confluence of politics and legal rulings that seem to be coming here. Politicians, especially on the right, are pushing the idea to very great effect now that religious freedom is under threat, a kind of new aggrieved minority. Now, at the same time, Chief Justice John Roberts himself wrote that there is little doubt that cases like this, maybe not Kim Davis, but other cases of private citizens seeking accommodations to same-sex marriage based on First Amendment religious minority claims. He said there's no question that similar questions like that will soon be before the court. This fight is ahead of us.
Of course this fight is ahead of us. There will be couples, and there have been in cases in Oregon and Colorado, where same-sex couples seek the services of people in the public square who offer their services, whether they be wedding planners or photographers, etc. And our basic law in this country is that if you put yourself out into the commercial marketplace, you don't discriminate. If there is a law in that state that bars sexual orientation discrimination, that should be, in my view, the basic rule. You don't discriminate if you're in the commercial sphere. But that requires us to have a national law that bars discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. We don't yet have that law. And so on the national scale, that conversation, those conflicts are still ahead of us. They don't exist today because of the lack of that non-discrimination law.
This might be a political question for a legal guy, Professor Markison, but one of the criticisms of the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision was that the court passed down a decision on the public and on the culture that wasn't settled politically. All of a sudden, abortion had to be legal in all states. It was included in a woman's right to privacy. I'm sort of distilling that decision. What that helped launch was a cultural divide that has led to a political war that we're all familiar with. Major right-to-life movement versus pro-choice movement that has divided the culture and the politics for all of the years since that decision. There have been warnings that the Obergefell decision has done much the same thing, that arguments over religious liberty and an aggrieved minority are going to plague this country for the next 50 years because it cuts almost the exact same way as Roe did.
I just don't think that's true. I think the every indication is that the society is moving, especially if you look at polls of people under the age of 30, under the age of 40, decisively in favor of equal rights for same-sex couples, that there isn't this same cultural divide you've seen over the abortion issue. Moreover, the court's job ultimately is not to look at public opinion polls and concern itself with whether there will be that kind of a public backlash. Certainly the court may and the individual justices may have regrets over something like that, but their job is to protect individual rights under the Constitution, including the right to equality. And if an aggrieved minority is being treated unequally, and that ends up being something that a group in society or even a majority in society has difficulty with adjusting to or accepting, that has to be something the court ultimately accepts as part of its brief, as part of its mission statement to deal with those concerns and nevertheless hand down a decision like Obergefell.
Sam Markison is a constitutional law professor at the University of Louisville in Kentucky. Thank you so much, Professor.
Happy to be with you, Todd.
So we're asking you where you stand. Should Kentucky Clerk Kim Davis be allowed to deny marriage licenses because of her religious beliefs? On our Facebook thread, hundreds of you have been weighing in on our Facebook page. Al Sullivan writes, defying courts for a higher moral position is a tradition in America, but it's also troubling since we have business owners who also do not want to serve gays. History shows us that after similar rulings giving African Americans their rights, racists did similar things. Ultimately, they were forced by the weight of the law to obey.
I'm Robert from Allen. I wonder if those supporting Kim Davis's objections to gay marriage and issuing license would support her if she said she was a devout Muslim and denied marriage license to gay because of the practice of Sharia law.
This is Dan Ruiz. I'm calling from Wheatley Heights, New York. And she should be held in contempt of court and fined heavily or go to jail for breaking the law like any other American would.
This is Susan Wansbro from Dallas, Texas. Would the people who are supporting her now still support Ms. Davis if she were Quaker and refused to issue concealed handgun permits because it violated her religious beliefs? I think not.
Also this hour, dealing with disaster. You can pay to be rescued. And Dan Richards, CEO of a company called Global Rescue, says he's just filling a need.
Who gets to decide who gets rescued and who gets scarce resources in the wake of a disaster or a nationwide catastrophe or emergency? In each instance, not only does Global Rescue have we historically provided our services to our clients, but we also bring a humanitarian capability to these countries when we respond.
And coming up, we talk to David Miliband, president of the International Rescue Committee and former Foreign Secretary of the UK, about the migrant crisis in Europe that's testing its borders and the humanity of its leaders.
Last year was a terrible world record, 20 million refugees around the world, 40 million people displaced within their own country. And the response of the international community, both in peacemaking in countries like Syria, but also in treating the symptoms of conflict, namely the refugee flow that results, has been very weak indeed.
Both of those conversations this hour on The Takeaway. Stay with us.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
The wretched refuse of your teeming shore, send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Those are some of the words, of course, inscribed at the base of the Statue of Liberty here in New York Harbor. For hundreds of thousands of refugees this summer, that golden door is Europe, and they are risking everything to get there. On Wednesday, images circulated online of a drowned 3-year-old Syrian boy lying face down on a Turkish beach. That photo, which many journalists and activists insisted be shown despite its graphic nature, was a stark reminder of the realities of a crisis that has gotten steadily worse as the summer has dragged on. Given the scale of the crisis, should we be doing more here in the United States? David Miliband is one of a growing number raising that question about our role here in America. He's president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee and a former foreign secretary in the United Kingdom.
Well, Europe has historically been a leader of the humanitarian system. It's been a leader of the drive for universal rights to be established. And there's no question that Europe is now in moral as well as political and policy crisis in the face of the tsunami of bad news, the terrible 4-5 year conflict in Syria, the ongoing conflict in Somalia and Congo that is producing a wave of refugees the like of which the world has never seen before. Just for the benefit of your listeners, last year was a terrible world record, 20 million refugees around the world, 40 million people displaced within their own country. And the response of the international community, both in peacemaking in countries like Syria, but also in treating the symptoms of conflict, namely the refugee flow that results, has been very weak indeed. And Europe has been consumed by the crisis in Ukraine, by the euro crisis in Greece over the last 2 or 3 years, and frankly hasn't had its eye on the ball of this refugee crisis. That means that a country like Germany wakes up today and says, we're going to have 800,000 asylum seekers in our country this year. And this is certainly a European crisis that demands a European response. But frankly, it also demands an international response, including the United States, because historically the US has taken a very large number, about 50% of the world's resettled refugees. But since the Syria conflict started, only 1,434, to be absolutely precise, have arrived in the US. And so there has been inertia where there needs to be leadership. And that's really a fundamental challenge, yes, to the European countries that have got this stock of people now inside Europe who they need to share out, but also globally to tackle the roots of the problem and to deal with its symptoms.
So the U.S. government and the U.S. State Department has come under some criticism and, in your view, justified criticism for not taking a more active role with the crippling refugee crisis from the Syrian conflict. At the same time, Mr. Secretary, we are in the midst of a political season in this country where a big part of the conversation, frankly, is about the opposite. A major part of the debate right now, at least in the Republican primary, is about building a wall, building a fence between the United States and Mexico. Sure, on a practical level, it may never happen, but the symbolism of such a wall and such a fence and such an attitude, I would take it as a bit troubling to you.
Well, I obviously am a relative newcomer to the United States, as you can tell from my accent. I observe U.S. politics as an observer rather than as a participant, but I can bring to bear some experience from elsewhere. Look, the debate about walls in Europe has shown that the bigger the walls, the more ingenious or the more criminal are the attempts to get round them. The absence of legal routes into Europe for those fleeing for their lives means that there's real empowerment of criminal gangs who are the last hope for people who are being barrel-bombed in their homes in Syria and don't have legal routes to claim refugee status. And it's obviously not for me as the leader of an NGO to become involved in partisan politics, still less intra-party politics within the Democratic or Republican parties. But what I think is clear is that this country has historically been a leader in refugee resettlement and has been a leading light for the benefits of a diverse society. E pluribus unum, after all, has been the defining element of this country and has brought people from all around the world and actually brought people to New York, to this city, as the ultimate global city. And I think that the management of refugee flows is a feature of the modern world, where the attempt to believe that it can that there can be crisis in the Middle East or crisis across Africa and not affect the rest of us just is belied by reality. And I hope that the positive examples of managed migration and managed refugee flows in the United States is something that Europeans will learn from in a positive way.
David Miliband, we're going to let you go right before we do. On a personal note, if I might, talk about your own motivation in being involved with International Rescue Committee and all of these issues when it comes to refugee crisis, education, healthcare, and conflict zones. Many Americans won't know that your own father, Ralph Miliband, was a Jewish refugee in World War II himself. This is part of your background.
Well, thanks for raising that. I mean, professional life and personal life do come together. My father and grandfather were refugees to the United Kingdom in 1940. My mother spent the Second World War in hiding in Poland and became a refugee to the UK in 1946. And so there is a personal element to the passion that I bring to the International Rescue Committee and the issues that we're addressing. As it happens, I also know that my grandfather, who spent the war in the UK with my dad, when he went back to Belgium in 1945 to rescue his wife and his daughter and successfully rescue them, he was then denied entry into the UK because there wasn't enough room for economic migrants as opposed to refugees. And one of the striking things about the current Europe crisis is that the distinction between a refugee and a migrant is being lost. A refugee is someone who has a well-founded fear of persecution. It's a legal status established in international law, and it's provided a life-saving haven for literally millions of people over the years, including my family. An immigrant, someone who's seeking a better life, is in a different category and doesn't have the same kind of rights. And I hope that there comes out of this Europe crisis a greater understanding of the need to defend the status of refugees as people in desperate need of help and in need of protection that has long been offered by countries like the US and the UK. And I'm honored to be part of the drive to help achieve that.
David Miliband is president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. He's also the former Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom. David Miliband, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
No one wants to think about the possibility of a storm of wildfires ripping through their town or a magnitude 9 earthquake. Or what they would do in the tsunami or landslides that came afterward. But catastrophes like Hurricane Katrina 10 years ago or the wildfires ravaging Washington and Montana right now, they don't politely announce themselves. In cities, they need to prepare. So that brings us to Seattle. It's a city that's prone to earthquakes and landslides. There's also an active volcano nearby. Yep, that's Mount Rainier. Barb Graff is the director of Seattle's Office of Emergency Management, and she's in charge of preparing Seattleites for the very worst. Barb, welcome.
Thank you, Todd.
There is, I've read, a 15% chance of a magnitude 9 quake along the subduction zone near Seattle over the next 50 years. That's a pretty good chance.
We've got three different types of earthquakes that hit the Northwest, and the one you're talking about is a subduction zone earthquake. Very large, lasts for minutes, not seconds, the kind that ripped through Anchorage, Alaska in 1964. But we also are prone to earthquakes that can happen very shallow within the Earth's crust, right under our feet. There's a fault that's actually named the Seattle Fault. And then every 20 to 30 years or so, we have a deep source earthquake like we had in 2001, 1965, and 1949.
What kind of early warning system does Seattle have now?
It's not just Seattle. Since earthquakes are so large, you have to have a warning system that protects a much larger area. The University of Washington and the U.S. Geological Service has been instituting an earthquake early warning program that would warn all of Western Washington and some, I believe, into Western Oregon as well. And that's being prototyped at the moment. An earthquake early warning system has really two parts to it. One is sensing the motion and sending a signal. If the epicenter, the center of the earthquake, is very near, you only get a couple seconds warning. If it's further away, say in southern British Columbia or northern California, you might get a few minutes of warning. But the second part of the system is for people to know what to do with it. And so there needs to be technology installed in hospitals and in transportation corridors that would shut down critical applications without any type of human intervention.
So that part's automatic, but once all the automatic stuff happens, you really need a culture of preparedness. That's hard to do because people have a culture of wanting to do lots of other things besides prepare for a disaster that they don't want to think about. So what does Seattle do to get those Seattleites down with preparing?
We teach at least 250 programs every single year, directly reaching about 8,000 people minimum, in order to teach them about the risk of earthquake and other hazards and what they can do to protect their safety. Additionally, we reach out to people within cultural groups or English as second language groups in order to teach them to teach their own communities in order to have more of an exponential effect.
So I don't know if there's a way to answer kind of a snarky question, but in your estimation, Barb Graff, Seattle is ready for the big one? I guess you're never really ready.
you're never completely ready, but you never stop chipping away at preparedness. So the voters here in Seattle passed a levy several years ago that seismically retrofit all of our fire stations. We've installed generators at our largest community centers that could act as shelters. We pre-positioned emergency supplies throughout the community. We hardened our hydrants so that the fire department could draw water directly from reservoirs if they needed to. Our public utilities works with other neighboring cities on resiliency studies. So you just never stop.
A city of preppers, that's what Seattleites are. Major preparedness going on in anticipation, possibly, of the big one that we all hope never comes. Barb Graff is director of Seattle's Office of Emergency Management. Barb, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Todd.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
Had about a year of racially charged violence and a renewed reflection on race across the country. But in one corner of the United States, a church has decided to make a move in the direction of accountability and reconciliation on its own. The Rhode Island Episcopal Diocese is planning a center for reconciliation in acknowledgement of both the state and the diocese's long involvement with the transatlantic slave trade in the 17th and 18th centuries. Rhode Island merchants may have controlled as much as 90% of the American trade in African slaves in the years following the Revolution, and the state was once called the Deep North for its heavy involvement. The Reconciliation Center is among the first of its kind in the U.S. Bishop Nicholas Knisley, who has led the Rhode Island Episcopal Diocese since 2012, says his hope for the center is to serve as a kind of historical experience with artifacts, exhibits, performances, to help the community better understand the role of the church in this tiny northern state that played an outsized role in America's dark past.
We have been talking about how to do reconciliation in America. How do we as American people become reconciled with our history? How do we as American people become reconciled to one another so that we can live together as one nation and not see the inequities and the economic disparities and the law enforcement differences that we're seeing in the country today?
And so your Reconciliation Center sounds like it's a first step for that.
It really is. It grew out of some grassroots conversation here in Rhode Island among people when we were confronted with the question of a cathedral that had had its services suspended. And I asked the people around the state to dream about what we might do with this building. What mission might we take on as people of faith? And the thing that came out was people being brave enough to confront Rhode Island's history and to confront our history as American people of a place that is marked by our involvement in the slave industry.
Now, let's talk about that history a little bit, because at very first glance, blushing glance, you say, well, Rhode Island is New England. This is not South Carolina. This is not Georgia. What slave history? What exactly are you talking about?
Well, it's been a surprise to me to find out, but as a person who was born in the North, as I have begun to listen to people who've talked about the history of Northern slave ownership, we've discovered that Rhode Island in particular as a state, but all really of the North, has been participating in the slave industry in the 18th century to a much greater degree than I think any of us knew or understood. In Rhode Island, we know that many of the ships that brought people from Africa to the slave plantations in the South and into slavery in the North were sailing under Rhode Island registration. And Rhode Island as an economy, all the people of Rhode Island in those days were participating in this industry in direct and indirect ways.
So that means that if the ships were being built in Rhode Island, were disembarking from Rhode Island, the captains made their homes in Rhode Island, and the financiers did their banking in Rhode Island, that the economy of Rhode Island was implicitly and intimately intertwined with the slave trade.
Well, and the barrel makers and the people who were weaving cloth, the people who were dealing with the cotton that was coming off the plantations, yeah.
You have also talked about the role of your own church and some of its prominent members in the slave trade, the direct role of the Episcopal Church going back into the 18th century. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, so it's a mixed bag, and I think that's what we want to talk about as people of faith. And we want to talk about the way people of faith participated and were enriched by the slave industry, and we want to talk about the way that people of faith over the years, not as many Episcopalians as I'd like to say, participated in the work of abolition of slavery in the United States. But as an institution, even after abolition, even after the Civil War, the church has still benefited from the implications of slave trade. Many of our institutions were able to amass wealth in that time, and we still have income from those wealth-bearing industries. Some of the buildings that we use were built with money that comes from that period. Some of the structures within the church that still show inequities come directly from that period as well and propagate into our own day.
There is a long-running debate, argument in this country, as you know, sometimes a hurtful and ugly one, about apologies, about responsibility for slavery, what it means to try to reconcile or even apologize for something that you weren't directly involved in, or even maybe your ancestors weren't involved in. Maybe your family came here in the 20s. Can you talk about a response to that, whether direct descendancy from the slave trade is necessary here to be part of what you're talking about?
So let me be personal here for a second and say that as my family has done investigation into its own history, we who thought of ourselves as being from Pennsylvania and from the South were surprised to find out that we have deep roots here in Rhode Island and ancestors buried in graveyards across the street from Episcopal churches. And that when we've looked at the census data from that time in our own families, we've discovered that we were slave owners in that day. I think people don't really recognize the interconnectedness and how deeply we all are related to this. Now, as to questions of people who've come here after the Civil War, who've come here recently, a lot of American society is built still on this kind of inequity. Look at the question of how we did redlining in the way we did real estate in the cities. Look at how the GI Bill was disproportionately given to one group of GIs and not to another group of GIs. People get a leg up and they're not always aware of the leg up that they've been given simply because they are identified as white or not. And people are being held back because they're identified as not white, even though we're pretty sure that those are societal constructions and have very little to do with ethnic or genetic structures.
Bishop Nicholas Knisely, I'm hearing a lot of commonality in what you're talking about with a book I read recently for our book club here on The Takeaway, and it was Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. He is a journalist at The Atlantic and an author of that book. He says that white Americans or Americans who think of themselves as white can't begin to reconcile with their treatment of African Americans until they realize on a visceral, even a practical level, that their social position has been built on the shoulders, if not the necks, of other people. And I hear a lot of common themes in what you're saying.
I absolutely agree. By the way, my book club of clergy is reading this book in the next month. In a conversation I had with a leader in the Episcopal Church about this question, he, as an African-American leader, said to me that we really have to start as white people by knowing our own history. The black community knows our history. We've lived in denial of it. And that's kind of at the core of what the Center for Reconciliation is about. We can't be reconciled with one another until we are all telling the truth. And this is about white people telling our truth to ourselves. As much as it might be someday issuing a kind of apology, though I'm not sure what the apology would look like or who would accept it, I'm not sure who has standing for it. We're not there yet. First, we have to know what we did.
Bishop Nicholas Knisely is the Episcopal Bishop of Rhode Island since 2012. The Rhode Island Episcopal Diocese has founded the Center for Reconciliation, an exploration of Rhode Island's role in the slave trade and the role of its people as well. Bishop, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks very much.
Well, as Rhode Island deals with its past, here are some more of your hometown stories before we go today. A listener in Austin, Texas writes, "My hometown of Cleveland was once one of the wealthiest cities in the country in the late 1800s and early 1900s. A particularly grand two-mile stretch of Euclid Avenue was known as Millionaire's Row. Most all of the mansions are gone now, but fortunately, the theaters remain as an anchor in downtown Cleveland's renaissance."
Hi, this is Perry from Tampa, Florida. And in addition to its own rich history of gangsters, from Charlie Wall to Sancho Tropicante, Tampa was also a popular vacation stop for other more famous mobsters like Al Capone. Of course, Miami was the better-known vacation stop, but that's because people knew where it was.
We're getting lots of great stories from you. That's all for today, but you can listen back to anything you heard on the show at thetakeaway.org. You can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thank you so much for listening, as always. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.